Burnt Norton. Time present and time past are both perhaps present in time future, and time future contained in time past. If all time is eternally present, all time is unredeemable. What might have been is an abstraction, remaining a perpetual possibility only in a world of speculation. What might have been and what has been point to one end which is always present. Footfalls echo in the memory, down the passage which we did not take, towards the door we never opened into the rose garden.
July 19, 1968. Griffin has advised me that Dr. Rann has suggested that her participation in my research may jeopardize her status as a graduate student, and is certainly adverse to continued employment by him as his assistant when the fall semester begins. I told her that this is not possible, and that if he would not employ her, then I certainly would, as I would need to replace Howard in any event. Howard's having come to live with us, sleeping with Zoe, has been generally well received by the girls, sharing tender sympathies toward their romance, sweet as it is, sympathies I also feel. But Mock Turtle is uncomfortable with it, I think. I have discovered she shares the conventional religious sentiments of Hedgehog, whom it seems shared the apartment with her and Griffin. I had not known. She is more tolerant, less ideological in her beliefs than Hedgehog, however, and she loves Zoe as a sister, as I love her as if my daughter. It is so easy to love her. And I think she sees that Howard sincerely loves Zoe and wishes to marry her, but that under the circumstances a conscience constrains him. I remember that conscience and this circumstance. The desperation of war, the uncertainty of life, the passion of a youthful love. He did not want to marry me either. I would have married him immediately. I do not care that he might be killed. I loved him as Zoe loves Howard. I cannot explain to Howard how wrong he is. I know he is acting out of his love, if forsaking it unintentionally, sadly, foolishly, I think. I understand. But life is always endangered, and happiness does not wait. It may be lost, forever lost. July 19, 1968. Rhine Zener cards with black symbols on white stock, a cross, a star, a circle, a square, and three wavy lines, have been employed in credible ESP research since 1933 by Zener, who invented them, by Rhine, and subsequently by the Princeton studies, on which I recently favorably commented in peer review. Our use of them is therefore provided a validated methodology for axiomatic perception. In addition, the available data from these other research efforts offer benchmark comparison to ESP phenomena. Our control data shall also stand as a data point to confirm reports of axiomatic experience. Howard suggested it as a method by which we might validate the alleged durations of axiomatic experience, and to confirm the association with the interval of gamma brain waves we witness, stage 3. It is simply that we ask the subject to tell the time of first awareness of being out of body, and if possible of their return to body or their intent to return, and to report that time to us. For the purpose, we have put an illuminated clock in the observation room and four more clocks on the four walls of the main room. Each clock is numbered. The clocks are synchronized before each experiment begins. The subject must report the clock identity and note the time told in order that the perception be considered reliable. It has proven not to be difficult for any of the subjects to perform this task, although the concluding time is less often obtained. In both the application of the Zener cards and the clocks, subjects are routinely briefed before each induction. In the case of the Zener cards, one card is placed face up in front of me on my desk. One is placed at the back of the room on another table. Subjects are shown the two stations of cards in this placement before the experiment and are told that the cards would be replaced and therefore the pictures on them would likely change, but not necessarily change. Each station was labeled with another note card as Station A or Station B. The card before me was Station A. The card at the back of the room was Station B. The subject is asked to identify both the station and the card. Once the subject enters the observation room, the Zener deck is shuffled and the cards are selected for the two stations. The initial round of Zener card identification experiments, two per subject, 18 events, has been completed. Of these, 15 resulted in exomatic incidents of sufficient duration. Of these, 13 have resulted in confirmed observations. In 12 of these 13 incidents, 24 valid data points were taken. The one incident could not be validated against certain control data, and so it was discarded, although the card identifications were correct. Of the 24 valid data points taken, the subject correctly identified the Zener card in 22. A correct identification by out-of-body perception of 91.6%. The usual null hypothesis applied results in a correlation that may be functionally equivalent to normal day-to-day perception, if allowing for mundane error in ordinary communications, that is, misunderstanding or confused recollection. This is to say, the exomatic perception is essentially proved valid and reliable, equivalent to sensory perception, and moreover, it is in this regard expressly dissimilar to run-of-the-mill ESP, where the perception is many magnitudes greater than chance, but is not reliable. 13 August, 1968. The Guardian reported that the last steam passenger train service in Britain ran on August 11 to Manchester, along the rock-faced river. For me, in a recessed memory of some uncertain meaning, the feeling arises, nostalgia, it seems, wishful to return. If I shall die to live again, in my heaven would be certain moments of my life when I was happy. This steam engine locomotive is the symbol of life's opportunities for me, because it took me to Oxford, the first I ever took, because it took me to London to see my cousin, whom I still miss, because the time that I last saw him, he was leaving on the train for duty. Or not quite the last time I saw him. But the sound of it, seething, the smell of it, sharply metallic, smoky, the monstrous iron animal of it, these are the triumph and the tragedy of civilization, it seems to me. The wings on which we ascend, the crash into which we fall. Thinking of this, wishing I had been present to take this last train myself, although perhaps the remembrance would have been more sorrowful than uplifting, I regret foregoing my usual British holiday. But this research is compelling, and I was glad to provide Howard with the funds by which he could travel and assist the McCarthy campaigns. It was important to both of us, a small sacrifice for me. The remaining exomatic experiences which we shall attempt to validate are 1. The intentional flight or instant movement to a distant place or person pre-selected, and 2. Telekinesis, in which a subject physically alters an environment, moving something, placing something, writing something, etc. Alice, Cheshire Cat, Griffin, and White Rabbit have reported past experiences similar to these. As a control, we shall include also those who have not reported such experiences. Of the classes of exomatic experiences identified, see entry 25568. Only one shall not be tested, and that is clairvoyance. I cannot see how this can be done, since this class of experience involves personal and highly significant events which cannot be predicted. Our first effort at intentional movement or flight occurred with Alice this afternoon and with Mock Turtle this morning. Alice's task, like Mock Turtle's, was to fly or intentionally remove herself to Howard, or expressly to go to his room, where he would be sitting at the desk facing the window with a Zenner card face up. He would additionally write a personal note of not more than 5 or 6 words for each visitor, which would be confirmed. Alice's flight was truly a flight. She had lifted out of our room, out of our building before. So has Griffin. These episodes are typically among the longest in duration, and they undertake challenges with more confidence than the others. Alice reported easily escaping the substructure, the facade of Green Hall, although habitually taking passages and passing through doors as if she might open them, but did not. It struck her later as amusing to have been so conventional in travel. My home is not much more than 6 or 7 blocks. There was a terrific thunderstorm outside. And again, it struck her that she should get drenched, but of course when she returned to her body, she had not been touched by the rain. She said she watched Howard from outside the house at the level of the second-story window where he sat, looking out through the streaming rain on the glass, and then, in a moment of intention, was inside, behind him. She said she could smell his aftershave. She read the note, 3 words. She identified the Zenner card, a star. She returned to her body without flight, but by will alone, instantly. Mock Turtle's experience was desperate and frightening. I cannot say where she went or what precisely she saw. She said she intended herself toward Howard, but that her feeling towards him, as she said, are complicated. I did not ask her to explain, for she came back in such terror, so suddenly, screaming, trembling, quite pale, that I was immediately concerned solely for her well-being. Griffin had more success calming her than I. She told us this. I came through a rapid rushing tunnel, a jarring noise like a crack of thunder, very close to me, and then suddenly there was someone in front of me. I called his name. He did not answer, but I felt his reply. It was friendly. He led me to a room. I felt the presence of more people, many, lying on the floor, writhing on the floor. I'm not sure what I saw, but what I felt was certain. They were naked and engaged sexually. They wanted me naked. They wanted me sexually. The one who led me there was calm and reassuring, but I was frightened. I bolted from his presence, a sucking sound, and I was here. She trembled still. I did not understand this. I presumed it was a psychotic break, a vivid hallucination of certain deep-seated neuroses. But as Griffin reassured her, she explained that she had also sometimes encountered other entities. It seemed She said that there may be other sentient entities in our universe, or within that realm which is the subject of exomatic experiences. But they are like us, not very different, not dangerous, and that her experience was perhaps a misunderstanding. Mock Turtle was insistent, hysterical in her insistence. This was no misunderstanding. It was real, and it was wicked. She looked distraught. She is right. There are things we should not know, referring then to Hedgehog by name. I understood then that Mock Turtle should not continue with Chimera. Griffin stayed to comfort her. I thought my presence was discomforting. Mock Turtle did not return with Griffin to the house, and I expect she will not return to live with us. 20 August, 1968. Howard left the house this morning, and for the next 10 days will be working with the McCarthy campaign in the headquarters in the Hilton downtown, sharing rooms with other workers. He may even receive floor privileges to the convention. How exciting! He knows that they will not prevail, but he believes in the cause. Griffin has agreed to assist in our continuing research. We have rearranged and reduced it, with Mock Turtle gone, and Griffin in her own other role. We have but 4 subjects. We are focusing for the last on free activities. We are maintaining the regimen of data collection, but have ceased designing experiments. All of these will be returning to school after Labor Day and will be moving out. Zoe will stay until Howard leaves for basic training. Griffin will become my assistant. Dr. Rand dismissed her as his own, and I have had to intervene with the chair on her behalf, but fortunately Rand had no basis other than antipathy toward me, on which to amend the formerly excellent reviews he had given her work. He has declared vitriolic protests, but the chair sees them for what they are. Griffin is nonetheless dismayed and is not used to such confrontations. I, myself, find it difficult to understand. I would like to think that the issue is a dispute of opinion. In my academic life, I have tried to find balance in such disputes. Usually the differing points of view, even if evidently contradictory, contain merit and may be reconciled. But here, Rand, Winslow, and others have posed a categorical stipulation, a first cause, much as an ecclesiastical authority addressing me for would-be scientific heresy. They are the church fathers to my Arianism, as it were, for I should believe that mind transfigures body, that mind and body are not one and the same, identical, 2-in-1, nor yet some sacred trinity, wherein to these our sanctimonious church fathers, the faculty of reason is Holy Ghost, bound to the consubstantial mind and body. I have argued with Rand that if dissection cannot find a soul in man, it also cannot find the faculty of reason. If soul is illusory, so may be all such insubstantial notions, so that logic is not more than conditioning, and so truth is learned outcome. This is, of course, puerile. I find myself tempted to give them argument of their kind. However, that is not how I should prevail. In the twisted strands of circumstance, the threads of time are so interwoven that what a coincidence appears seems intentional and meaningful. I do not know if this is the poetry, the rhyme of moment, or something like the synchronicity, as Jung would aver, or which, as I have suggested, may be the shuddering of events upon the spectrum of actuality, shimmering in and out as the potentiality appears. I saw closely watched trains last year at our local art house theater. It was amusing. It made me think about the officious communists in all governments, about the happenstance of choices, about the sensuality of yearning youth. And then soon after I saw this movie, the Prague Spring began. The same Oscar-winning director, whom the communists had obliged to surrender this Oscar, was now a hero among the Czechs, and the film became an allegory, a symbol of political rights. How? I cannot see. But signs are seen in the sky, and portents show in the flight of birds. Today, while we in America stand on the eve of our oppression, of 4 more years of war, indignantly and arrogantly defiant of democratic will, the Soviets invade Czechoslovakia. Just as our U.S. Army and police assemble en masse, surround, and intend to crush the political movement of our youth. Soviet tanks in Prague are counterpoised in television images to the phalanx of armored police, barricades, and barbed wire fencing prepared for protesters coming to Chicago. 29 August, 1968. Come, senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall, for he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. There's a battle outside, and it is raging. It'll soon shake your windows and rattle your walls, for the times, they are a-changing.
My words echo thus in your mind. But to what purpose? Disturbing the dust on a bowl of rose leaves, I do not know. Other echoes inhabit the garden. Shall we follow? Quick, said the bird, find them, round the corner, through the first gate, into our first world. Shall we follow the deception of the thrush into our first world? There they were, dignified, invisible, moving without pressure over the dead leaves, in the autumn heat, through the vibrant air, and the bird called in response to the unheard music hidden in the shrubbery, and the unseen eye-beam crossed for the flowers that are looked at. There they were, as our guests, accepted and accepting. So we moved, and they, in a formal pattern, along the empty alley into the box circle to look down into the drained pool. Dry the pool, dry concrete, brown-edged, and the pool was filled with water out of sunlight, and the lotus rose quietly, quietly. The surface glittered out of heart of light, and they were behind us, reflected in the pool. Then a cloud passed, and the pool was empty. Go, said the bird, for the leaves were full of children, hidden excitedly, containing laughter. Go, 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 said the bird. Humankind cannot bear very much reality. Time past and time future, what might have been and what has been, point to one end, which is always present.